This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation.
Hello, and welcome to Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Krishandu Ray, the chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at NYU. He was a faculty member and the associate dean of liberal arts at the Culinary Institute of America, and he's the author of The Migrant's Table, The Ethnic Restaurateur, and the co-editor of Curried Cultures, Globalization, Food, and South Asia. His most recent work is on street vending in global cities with attention to questions of law, livelihood, and the liveliness of cities. Krishandu, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I love your work.
Thanks.
You have put an academic sort of like backing and proof behind things that I have always felt about restaurants and food in America and the ways in which we engage with food, which is really how we engage with like class and race and gender. And so I'm really excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So let's talk about, I was reading this interview that you did where it was after The Ethnic Restaurateur had come out, and you actually heard from a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America who was like very upset with you about your book. Can you tell listeners that story?
I think it was a faculty member, a friend of mine. And
it was a faculty member.
Yeah. And I think and that's always one of the problems of analyzing something in a scholarly way, where you have to go a bit in the direction where the evidence takes you. And then people have good intentions, individuals, but my argument in the book is basically how it is stacked structurally to evaluate different foods differently, meaning that we, for the longest time, in the at least Western haute cuisine, in the chef circle, we have highly respected French techniques and styles of cooking. And subsequently, it almost took another 100 years for us to open up our mind to Italian style cooking. Mm-hmm. And that has not happened to many other cuisines. It has happened with Japanese, for instance, since about the 1980s. Chefs and this chef friend of mine kind of was upset that I didn't see enough of the individual effort to do good in the world. And my argument in the book is, what are the structural constraints in spite of good intentions, that it is an uneven playing field? That, for instance, it's very difficult for, say, Thai, regional African cuisines to even register in the horizon of Western chefs. And often they do, but in a derivative way, which is they would say, think about ingredients rather than techniques, as if there are no techniques other than other than French and Italian cuisine. So anyway, that was kind of a difficulty with which he was responding to this relationship between individual will and structural inequality. And my scholarship was mostly focusing on structural inequality. The first two chapters is about how individual restaurateurs and chefs are engaging with the world. But at the end of it, it says how it is made unequal by structural inequality. So I think that was what was difficult for him to digest.
Mm. And speaking of the kind of structural inequalities, it's very interesting that we're talking right now, because I'm working on the story about how culinary schools kind of, you know, use French and Italian techniques. And, you know, if we're trying to create well-rounded cooks, you know, why not teach a pilaf next to a jollof, or teach a mole next to the mother sauces? You know, like, why not make culinary education more inclusive? And, you know, there's been a little pushback in the interviews that I've done. Is it? Mm. Yeah, you know, people say French is the best, and that's what they want to stick to.
Presumption about it. I think it's a bit of the funny world of like peer review, in a sense. That is the peer review. That's where the chefs know the techniques and can evaluate a consommé, while they don't know how to deal with a biryani or a jollof. And so in a sense, what happens, it almost the structure of the field forces you to narrow it. And that's why I don't think breaking out of it is that easy. It is complicated. It's difficult. It needs to be included. And when I left the Culinary Institute of America, in the last professional chef handbook, the cookbook, the book of techniques, they had began to incorporate a lot of interesting techniques, like, for instance, making garam masala from scratch. Mm. That was in the latest version of it. It was already being, you can see it, but almost for insiders, it's a sense that the change is too fast. We don't need to. And for outsiders, really? There's a sense, people like you and I, probably in this particular context, we see it as too slow, not fast enough, you know? And I remember at the Culinary Institute when we renamed the what used to be called the Oriental Kitchen.
Was it Cuisines of Asia?
Exactly, Cuisines of Asia, and then it was expanded.
Oriental,
it was like, I mean, it's part of it is language, part of it is the social world in which that language operates. Among chef, it was still legitimate to call something Oriental long before it had gone out of circulation, say in scholarly circles, okay? And then also the other part of it was real expansion from just a few Chinese techniques and one Chinese chef to then add Japanese very quickly, add Vietnamese, Indian, other parts of Thai. And so that I was watching this expansion, and it happened. I was there about a decade, and it was happening. So, and in fact, the chefs themselves were split in two camps. The older chefs, the more European chefs, saw this as declining standards, as changing standards, that they couldn't play the game anymore, and that this was suddenly changing the rules of the game. While the younger chefs tended to see it as too slow moving and not imaginative enough. And for most of my students, for instance, my students at the Culinary Institute were one of the first students to demand, for instance, that a vegetarian plate come out of every kitchen. There was no vegetarian. When I started teaching at the CIA, there was no vegetarian plate other than there would be some steamed vegetables, you know, and some carb.
Yeah. A risotto. Mushroom risotto.
Exactly. No thoughtful integration of cuisines, partly because it was not part of the European repertoire. It's only when the younger chefs kind of had a certain kind of a comfort and mastery of non-European cuisines, Indian cuisines, Southeast Asian cuisine, that they could even think of something imaginative as a vegetarian plate. So for instance, for the vegetarians, it was radical, this shift. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, there was a split between those who thought this was going down the wrong path, the point should be French technique, and then Italian technique was added on top of it. Fresh pasta making was added relatively recently, in fact. So it's kind of, and what we are talking about right now is exactly what I talk about in my book, about how our evaluation of cuisine changes over time and depending on class and race of the people we meet out there.
Yeah, another thing your work talks about so often, which is something that's very close to my heart, is are the mom and pop restaurants in this country. You know, there are something like 50,000 Chinese restaurants, and you talk about how people are unwilling to pay more than $10 for Chinese food, even though it is like highly skilled and, you know, regional differences and different flavors, and it's so complex and nuanced, yet people kind of just have this flattened idea of what Chinese food is.
And I think that's going to change. And that's kind of the interesting thing that's happening, because my argument at the end of the book is that, in fact, And I think The Atlantic encapsulated it in a piece where it said the future is expensive Chinese food. Because what we are beginning to see is at least kind of a twofold change, right? Which is, so what you're saying is exactly correct. We have had Chinese restaurants for at least 150 years, you know, since the 49ers. And their Chinese men got into cooking initially to feed themselves and feed their compatriots and eventually to feed white miners who didn't want to cook and clean. But they didn't want the Chinese in the gold mines. So they pushed the Chinese out, and eventually the Chinese men did what was seen as largely feminized labor, cooking and cleaning for white miners, partly racial discrimination and partly this kind of a social discrimination. But we have had Chinese restaurateurs becoming visible from about the 1850 onwards, but it's a very narrow and kind of a range of cooking, and most of it associated with cheap food. But that is changing right now. I think next 20 years, that's the radical change is going to be. One is because I think the in-migration of poor Chinese is going to end into the United States, partly because the Chinese economy is booming, and that has happened before, say, with Italian migrants. That has happened before with German migrants, with English migrants. They first leave in the first phase of capitalist development in the countryside, and then it flattens out, and then it ends this exit of poor people from the country to the city, and the city across nations as international migrants. And we are right in the middle of that transition today. And in fact, if you look at, if you run a Chinese restaurant today, your two major challenges, of course, in a city like New York is one, for everyone, which is real estate, which is your lease. But other than that, the second most important problem you have is you can't find cheap Chinese labor to cook in your restaurants. So my argument is, that is one change that's happening. And the second change is the rise of power, rise of visibility of China as an economic power, as a political power, and soft power, cultural power. These two things will converge over the next 20 years to, I think, totally demographically shift Chinese food from the bottom of the market now to the mid-market and some upscale. And we are beginning to see that with Taiwanese restaurateurs, with your bubble tea shops and stuff like that. And that's going to, in fact, also accelerate over the next probably 20 years.
That is, I think that's so fascinating. And like for me as someone like, you know, in food media, like I think we tend to hold on to this narrative of like, oh, everyone comes here and brings their food and we're a melting pot and we imagine this big communal table of everyone just bringing their food. And it's like, well, why do people come here? You know, because of, you know, conflict or, you know, needing it's way more complex than that.
But economically often pushed out of the countryside. And that's where migration has always been, you know, with probably the exception of the Jewish migration, where it was much more directly political exclusion. Most migrants have been economic migrants, and it's kind of I see migration as the flow of labor from labor cheap regions to regions with kind of more expensive labor, because migration in a sense is the labor market at work.
Mm-hmm. And you see it with pizza in New York City. Like pizza shops are, you know, the dollar slice places aren't staffed by people who are Italian.
They won't be. Very clearly can't be.
Right.
And especially if you have a group with upward mobility, say Italian, or what has happened, a good example is Jewish groups. Because Jewish groups had very high literacy rates even before they came to the U.S. Because of that, and because of public schools and colleges, they climbed very fast. And in fact, they climbed out of feeding people. So most Jewish delis for the longest time has no one Jewish in it, maybe other than the owner, you know? And you have seen that. In fact, today it's very difficult to find a down-market Jewish cook in a down-market restaurant. And that's going to happen with Italians and Greeks. It's happening. Another example from the community I have studied most intensively, Indians. For instance, most Indians don't run or work in Indian restaurants. They are mostly, Indian restaurants are run by Pakistanis or Bangladeshi, in fact. And the Indians who are involved in it are also the Indians with less kind of formal credentials, like degrees. Because the Indian migration is almost 70% of Indians coming to the U.S. have a bachelor's degree. So what I see is Indians are not going to be even more in the near future cooking even in Indian restaurants. And Indians will be, in fact, I see more and more of them writing and talking. They are part of this kind of, I would say, commentators on food.
Yes.
As exactly it happened, by the way, with Jewish commentators on food. They stopped cooking because they were pushed up, but they started writing. They had a much stronger presence in the writing about culture than about feeding other people. And that's happening right now, by the way, with Indians.
There is like a set of, you know, very, very prolific Indian American food writers. And exactly. it's very beautiful to watch.
Yes.
You know?
It is changing the discussion. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just not just Indian, I would say Asian American writers, in fact.
Yes.
There's a range from the San Francisco Chronicle to the New York Times. You begin to see people like Tejal Rao and, you know, and Mayuk Sen and others who are entering this domain. And that is also why I personally think that is why you have this very intense discussion about cultural appropriation, is the presence of, I think, people of color with middle class professional credentials who can write and talk back that used to be mostly a white field. And that is transforming. And so all this quarrel about cultural appropriation, I see it as a good symptom of how the field is being forced to change because of the presence of people of color who can talk back to what used to be historically white gourmandism.
To an establishment.
Absolutely. And that has happened before. And in this particular case, it happened with, say, music. Is a kind of a very interesting analogous domain. And so how other people entered it. For the longest time, there was a strong black presence, of course, in music making, but not in commenting, critiquing. Mm-hmm. And that changed, and that transformed, and that posed this whole question about the racial provenance of, say, jazz or, say, American popular music. What is the role of race in it? How much of it is black music turned white, etc.? All those questions that happened in music about a generation, two generations ago, is happening right now with food, because a new kind of a professional class of color, people like you, with, say, commenting on radio, are entering this domain and transforming the discussion about it, which is exciting and new.
It is an exciting time.
Yes.
Two things. One, so what does that mean if, you know, the people cooking Indian food in America aren't
Indians? Indians, most probably.
You know, what does that mean for, you know, how Americans are in I was about to say ingesting, you know, but approaching and understanding Indian food, does that mean that they have like a different sense of it than what it actually is?
Yeah. So, from the producer side of it, of course, which is often you get a particular kind. So if we stay with the case of Indian food, it becomes a genre of Indian food, which is mostly Northern Indian food, which is Mughlai cuisine, food of basically Indian restaurants. That's, I would say, a kind of an institutional food cooked mostly by Bangladeshi cooks who have a kind of a sweeter hand. For instance, much stronger presence of sugar than I would say in the cooking, and onions and garlic, sauteed onions and garlic, that gives it a particular kind of an inflection that, by the way, fits very well with the American expectation of a palate, which is a sweeter palate than, say, if you are from Southern India. Peninsular India, which is much more sour notes are stronger in it. Like if you have ever had, say, an idli or a dosa, which have become visible almost everywhere in India now, but they have a very quintessential southern inflection, which is tamarind and the kind of the sourness of fermentation. And so what you get in some ways, it is very difficult to get the sour, bitter notes in American Indian food as you would find in Indian regional cuisines. So I'm hoping maybe the next step would be more regionalization of it. And you see a bit more of it at the upscale end of it because the ownership there is more Indian, partly because Indians are better networked now. They can raise the money. They often raise the money in their networks. So a lot of the upscale restaurants, which are about, say, 10 to 15 restaurants, Indian restaurants, are owned by Indians and often work by Indians. But the middle and the bottom of the market is mostly owned and run by poorer Bangladeshi entrepreneurs, Pakistani, and some Indian with less formal credentials, Gujaratis and Punjabis.
Yeah, you talk about how class plays into this too, mm-hmm. and how, you know, Japanese cuisine is so highly revered and respected in American culture because of the price that it commands. Or is it
The other way
around? The other way around.
Also, it's both. I think it is. Excellent question. I think the part of it is the Japanese, contemporary Japanese cuisine, the sushi, which I would say started with the sushi craze in the 1980s, was the Japanese food that was produced and consumed by mostly Japanese managers and professionals. So if you look at New York City, Japanese food, the best Japanese food initially was always in the midtown around the expensive hotel, even now, okay, which is very unusual. So right. It's not in that sense an ethnic food. It is not like Chinese food coming out of Chinatown, okay? It is much more like an upscale food of the upper classes, mm-hmm. and which becomes comes to be associated as good food, and then people are A, more interested in it, and B, willing to pay the price. And in this particular case, so Japanese food comes to America, to American cities, mostly through Japanese managers. And then that becomes the kind of the site of translation, and eventually Americans learn to eat sushi, and eventually sushi is kind of partly appropriated within the American repertoire. And partly because people were willing to pay that price, two things become possible. You can have good ingredients and you can have skilled labor. If you're not willing to pay the price, your ingredients can't be good, your labor can't be that skilled. Okay? And that has happened, the burden of almost every other ethnic food, which it's a relational term. Ethnic by itself, in a sense, has always gestured towards a bit of bottom of the market and not willing to pay more than 10, 12, maybe maximum $15. But if you're willing to pay $35, $45, you can produce a very different kind of a cuisine. And we have seen that with, especially with Japanese food. We might be entering a version not that extreme with Chinese and a bit with Indian, because of the rise of China, the rise of India, the changing nature of these immigrants. But I think in the Chinese case, it'll be a lot more in the mid-market area rather than the upscale.
I think that's so fascinating. Like, it is true that the really high-end sushi places are crazy expensive. And also in the midtown area, which is it that proximity to mostly white diners, or is it a proximity to whiteness? Like, what?
I think twofold. One is it's a proxy. A lot of these restaurants were set up to feed Japanese managers. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they would stay in these hotels. And so they were often around these kind of midtown hotels, which then became also a way, because, say, people like you and I, how would we know about Japanese food in a sense unless we read about it? And in this particular case, we have a colleague of ours who we are working with, who's a Japanese manager. I know nothing about, I don't know how to use chopstick. I don't know what sushi is. And then he takes me to a Japanese restaurant, upscale Japanese restaurant. I eat with him. I develop the etiquette. I learn how to appreciate, because, you know, for the first time, when you eat any food, you may not like it. In fact, it's probably have to. When I first ate sushi, I didn't like it at all. Because I come from Eastern India, which is a rice and fish culture, and but fish is always cooked and hot, and so cold fish and in a sense plain rice was not something
that what is this?
It was a total violation of the rules of all Indian food. But I ate it once, and other people said, "Wow, this is cool and this is new, and you got to learn about it." So I ate it second time, third time. I would say I didn't even like it until almost a dozen times.
Wow.
Then I develop a palate for it. Mm-hmm. So in fact, that's a good example of things we can give time and money and our own thinking to, in this case, sushi. Or I'll give you another example. When I first came to the United States, I hadn't had a glass of wine before because India is not a wine-producing culture.
And your mom doesn't like wine, I read.
At all, yes. So for the question is, so once I started teaching at the CIA, I started going out to drink with my friends. And then I asked them, so how do you figure out what to drink? He says, the way you figure out a book, read it, talk about it, listen to other people talking about it. That's exactly what I did with wine. So in a sense, and here's a good example, things I have spent a lot of time learning and developing my palate and developing my vocabulary, say wine and sushi and different kinds of Japanese food. I have not done that yet with, say, as much with Mexican food, with Nigerian food, with South African food. So this is what I mean by the structural hierarchy of taste. It's not like just my goodwill. I'm interested, okay, in the very various moles of Mexico. In fact, Mexican food is entering that very interesting phase of many more of us are familiar with it, are willing to invest time, energy, and intellectual resources thinking and writing and talking about it, but not so much yet Nigerian food or many other cuisines of the world. And that is what I mean by the real structural inequality. So for instance, the amount of time I have invested in learning about pasta shapes, okay, which is a very Italian thing, which by the way is the weirdest thing for an outsider, that the name changes by the shape of a food, not by what it is, but by the shape of a food. You have to learn that. You have to figure out the different tastes, different way they uptake sauces, okay? And that's, you have to pay some attention to it. And you won't get it the first time. You probably won't get it the 10th time, just like I didn't get sushi until maybe the 12th time. But I haven't even eaten Nigerian food 12 times to come to that. And partly because, in a sense, that my social circle, my social world doesn't say to me, eat Nigerian food, otherwise you'll be so uncool, like they said with sushi. So that's the structural inequality. So it's almost like, which goes back to, remember, our first discussion, why my friend was a little upset that I said individual will, including my own will. I have studied all this. I've written about all this. Cannot totally reshape the inequality and unevenness of the field.
Right.
Okay. And that's, I mean, it might radically change 20 years down the road. It might be that all my friends are eating Nigerian food and I would be excluded out of it if I don't eat Nigerian food. And maybe then I'll finally learn about Nigerian food just as I learned about wine, just as I learned about sushi, just as I learned about cheese. I mean, cheese was the toughest thing for me to get used to. It's the stinkiest thing in the world. I'm not used to it, you know? And then you have to develop a palate. You have to develop a language. So this is what I mean by that structural inequality. So I think it's to go back to your question, it is a demand side problem and a supply side problem. Mm-hmm. That is, we have to demand and be willing to pay a certain kind of money and then while learning about it. And that's what we were willing to do with the Japanese. And my argument is that is because we were engaging with the Japanese professional class that we wanted to engage with. While poor people, we usually do not have as much kind of patience, kind of a durable interest in poor people's culture that we want to learn. And that is what I call a cultural hierarchy of taste.
Wow. You also made the comparison of, you know, food culture to music culture and how we're a couple or a few decades behind, you know, having the same conversations we were having about music, we're now having about food.
Absolutely.
So what does that mean in terms of this country's food? Well, is there an American cuisine? I'd say no, but like I'm curious what you think.
My answer, in a sense, I say there is an American cuisine, but it changes every 40 years, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I personally think, in fact, it's a sign of how American culture, in spite of its inequalities, is much better at absorbing foreign cultures, immigrant presences, than many other cultures. Cultures I've come from, India, for instance, okay, or European culture. I've been working and traveling a lot in Europe. In Europe, the pride with their own cuisines is a kind of an obstacle to appreciating the structure of other cuisines, especially immigrant cuisines, you know? So in some funny way, the less enamored you are by your own great culture, the more open-minded you are to other people's culture. So I think in that case, the American case is a very different form than the European notion of cuisine. It's not about, I almost say, it is not only about roots, but it's about routes of change and transformation. And so American cuisine exists. It changes for every 40 years. And that's a good thing because it's a symptom of integration of immigrants into the American culture.
Wow. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Crescendo Ray.
This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation. Tucked in a 640-square-foot shipping container space in the heart of Denver's Rhino neighborhood, Cart Driver is the perfect place to stop in for an Italian-style spritz, Prosecco on tap, and a wide variety of tinned fish. Open for lunch, dinner, community hour, and late night 7 days a week, Cart Driver is here for you with fresh, domestically sourced ingredients, and above all, hospitality. Learn more at cart-driver.com.
All right, so we are back, and we're going to get a bit more personal.
Yes.
Because I want to know how you came to this work.
That's a long story. You have to stop me at some point of time. And so I came to the U.S. as a graduate student, and the first thing I realized was that I didn't know how to cook, to eat Indian food. I had to cook Indian food. So I had to learn up the skills. But the more important realization was, here I was a 20-something male, South Asian male, and I had eaten at least 3 meals a day my whole life, and I had never thought about the process, the method, the work of people who fed me. That was a startling realization because I had done progressive politics, I had done labor union organizing, even as a high school kid, and I had fought for all kinds of progressive public agendas. And I was surrounded by feminist women in Delhi who never told me to go home and cook, partly because they were themselves fleeing the kitchen in some ways. So for me, in some ways, which was the biggest realization, how immigration itself becomes an education. In this particular case, was a lovely, startling realization that saying, wow, I got to think about this. So I started working on food. And I went and talked to my advisor. He said, don't work on it. No one was going to give you a job. Because this was just before food was beginning to become visible in the public domain. I said, I'm so bothered by it and so intrigued by it. I would love to work on it. So I wrote my dissertation. And my dissertation eventually became the book, The Migrant's Table, which was this whole question of, I was connecting my own nostalgia for Indian food through immigration and looking at other people. So I interviewed 126 people, went to their homes, cooked, looked at their refrigerators, and that was the product of my book. So that's the kind of the fork in the road by which I came to work on food. I would say the shortest answer to that is through my own nostalgia and startling recognition of my own unassumed privilege. Mm-hmm. Of as a South Asian male. Mm-hmm. And South Asia is, in terms of gender work at home, is one of the worst in the world. By some OECD ranking, India is about next to the last. I forget which is the last country in terms of caregiving work at home, which includes cooking, cleaning.
Terms of women being expected to do that.
Do labor. It, and men not expected to do it. So, and this is cooking, cleaning, feeding of children and elders in any society. Someone has to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, in some societies, we do it more institutionally. Some societies, we do it in the household. And it is everywhere gendered, where women do a lot more of this work than anyone else. In India, it is a lot more gendered than almost anywhere else in the world.
Wow. So I'm curious, did you have any dining traditions growing up?
Yes. I would say two things. One was we ate almost every day my mother's home cooking.
Wow.
But I'm embarrassed to say we didn't help her at all. She didn't ask us. We were not expected. And we were just expected to say thank you and carry our plates back to the kitchen. But we didn't even do the dishes. Mm. It was a terribly unequal relationship, and my mother apparently did it with great joy, but I'm sure with great resentment that I feel now when my son leaves his dirty dishes in the sink.
How many of you were there?
Yeah, there were two of us siblings, me and my younger brother, 5 years younger than me, and my dad and my mom. In fact, that's the generation in India that the family size became really small, where compared to both my parents, they are like, they're 13 and 11 siblings. So that's that generation.
That's a lot of aunts and uncles.
Yes. It was kind of a lot of fun. I grew up with a lot of, we are lower middle class, barely out of the working class. So the only thing where we really relished and got pleasure out of was good food. And that was important. But it was a lot of work by women, invisible, and often servants in India. And that's, in fact, next 20 years, that's going to change in India, too. And it's going to be interesting to watch what happens to what I call the servant-wife complex of cookery. That's, in a sense, what's happening in India is what was happening in the, say, American South or in the United States in the early 20th century, where we are no longer going to be a society of servants and masters. And we can no longer assume to live off other people's work in close proximity. Who is going to do the cooking? And women's commutes, women are entering the labor force much more intensively. Their commutes are getting longer because cities are becoming big and crowded. And India, most Indian cities don't have a very good mass transit system. So who's going to cook when a woman has to travel 3-4 hours a day, do 8 hours of work out there and come back home and will be expected to cook? So two things are going to change. One is structurally someone else will have to cook. Most probably in the American case, the answer was industry, the food industry, convenience food. That's how convenience food becomes important. And the other side, in some ways, is men will be forced to probably step up a bit in
you
terms
said in
of
the
game.
Next like 20 years?
20 years.
Wow.
I can see that.
Wow. And so, and that's interesting. I hadn't thought about convenience foods stepping in.
You
in
have
that
to.
Way.
When people are pulled out of the household, right. Women and servants, industry has moved into that. So that's why it's not like just Americans made a bad choice about industrialized processed food, but that was necessary to, in fact, the way the labor market got restructured. And India is just now going through that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the food tradition of my home is the traditional household, nuclear family. Mom cooks every day, all the meals, especially breakfast and dinner, and dependent on it. So that was one side of it. The other side of it was we never ate at a restaurant. We ate twice a year in a restaurant. And the only restaurant in this little town we were growing up in called Cuttack in Odisha, state of Odisha, where my mother is Odia, it's a linguistic group, and my father is Bengali, that's another linguistic group. Think about Odia and Bengali as kind of like Italian and Spanish, but with different scripts, okay? And so the only restaurants we went to was my birthday and my brother's birthday. And by the way, that's again with my generation, that birthdays come to be celebrated. My parents' birthdays were never celebrated.
Really?
As a separate individual thing. It was considered too individualized, you know?
Wow.
And we went to a restaurant. And there were two restaurants in this town. One was named Hong Kong. The other was named Waldorf. And they were both run by Chinese immigrants in India. And there's, especially in Calcutta, there's a Chinatown, which had Chinese immigrants from the first half of the 20th century because of the various European colonization of China, parts of China, and then the Chinese Civil War had forced a bunch of people out, and they had come to Calcutta, the port, and established a Chinatown in Calcutta. And often from there, they were dispersed, and two of them ended up in this small town about 200 kilometers south of Calcutta, running two restaurants named Hong Kong and Waldorf.
Why Waldorf?
I think it was a bit like that was the global, at that point of time, it was considered something fancy.
Oh, like the Waldorf Astoria, Waldorf Salad.
So, exactly. So it was a name they wanted to give because Chinese, and that's an important thing, because Chinese food was for us the way we saw cosmopolitanism. Mm. It was not too Western food. We didn't have any Western food. For us, Chinese food was what was foreign and exotic and, in fact, elite. And so it's very different. It was not cheap food. It was good restaurant food. By the way, it's the first place in my life I use a fork in my life, which is with Chinese food. We never got chopstick. We got forks. Because noodles, you have to use chopstick or fork. Otherwise, it's very difficult to eat. And Indian cuisine does not have noodles in it. So we consume all our foods with our hands. And so that, for us, was a crucial idea of something foreign and exotic and elite, which of course turns out to be, in a sense, not true, but in a sense true, because it was our reach for cosmopolitanism, use of fork, use of a finger bowl at the end of it. It was considered very sophisticated for us to do that.
Do you remember what you ate?
So it would be, some of it would be versions of Indian style lo mein, which will be a little more spicy now, I realize. And it's kind of quite substantially Indianized. But boy, did we love it. And it'll be like a shrimp tempura now, I realize. And it felt, it was like so extraordinary, A, to have shrimp, B, whole shrimp fried in batter, and then soy sauce. And then Indians do a very specific kind of the side they have with chopped up Thai chilies in a vinegar that is always served along with Chinese food. I thought that was totally Chinese. Of course, turns out to be it's totally Indian. And then you put all that. So think about putting chopped Thai chilies in a vinegar on top of all the dishes you were eating. And we thought that was kind of very cool.
It honestly sounds very good right now.
It is
now.
Very good. In fact, my mouth is watering good. Right now thinking about it.
Same. So I'm curious, do you have a favorite restaurant here in New York?
Favorite restaurant?
Or a restaurant that you go to the most?
Yeah. So it's, I think it's driven for me a bit by convenience, which is I often entertain people, meet with people. So it'll be close to my work, which will be in the Village. And so if I think I can afford to spend a little more money, my favorite place is Il Buco Alimentari in Vineria. Or if I want to spend a little less money and have a good salad and a lovely pasta, it's Bar Primi. And so it's almost all of these places are about 10-15 minutes around from my work, and which is related to usually some version of a business lunch.
So I'm curious how you see New York's food scene, restaurant scene changing in the next two decades.
Yeah, I'm hoping two things, and I think it's going to happen. More regionalization of cuisines that we are unfamiliar with, meaning there's a degree of regionalization with Italian food and some degree of regionalization with French food, but we have had very little regionalization of Indian food, Thai food a bit, Northern Thai and Southern Thai, but not enough, I think. And I'm hoping some interesting African cuisines that is not only Ethiopian and Moroccan, which are the only two cuisines you see some hold in the New York City marketplace. So. And the other thing I see is much more exciting and interesting Chinese food, mid to upscale. And again, mid to upscale because people have to be willing to pay the price for good ingredients and good techniques and good skill. So someone can really make a good living out of it. Mm-hmm. If you are paying $5 to $7 to $12 for a meal, the workers can't be paid well. The ingredients can't be that good. So I see the big transformation is much more interesting Chinese food. And another thing I'm noticing is a very interesting way in which upscale Mexican food is entering the marketplace, which is somewhat a little contradictory to my hypotheses about number of migrants, poor migrants. We still have about 35 million, in fact, Americans who identify of Mexican heritage. But the Mexican food is interestingly, I would say, coming down, from the top chefs, the celebrity chefs, who are beginning to play a lot more with Mexican food. And a bit of it is the reputation of Mexican amongst American chefs, mm-hmm. People like David Chang, people like, and globally also, say, people with Rene Redzepi, who has been working with very interesting concepts. And that is an interesting development. We are probably going to see a lot more interesting but very upscale Mexican food. And very interesting mid-market Chinese food. But I'm really hoping we get regional other African cuisines, mm-hmm. we get regional Indian cuisines, and we get more regional Southeast Asian cuisines.
These are all good things to me. These all sound really good, and they're making me really hungry. you brought some like visual aids with you. I want to make sure you get time to talk through these.
Yeah, no, I'm just a professor, so I always need a bunch of paper and a bunch of books. And some of it was this. I'm rereading Jessica Harris's book, High on the Hog, which I think I'm realizing how advanced it was when she wrote it. And I'm rereading it, and I didn't remember that it opens with this beautiful market scene in Benin, and she says kind of how West African markets, how lively they are, and that is the connection I'm working on with my next projects, with this whole question of markets and marketplaces as social infrastructure, as that's a place where people meet, we learn about other people, we learn about produce, and engage with difference. And so markets are not just profit-making sites, but markets are also culture-making sites. Mm.
Yes, that book is actually being developed into a television show as well.
Is it really?
It is, yes. Huh. And I don't know where it is in the process of that. But my last question for you, which I cannot believe we're at this time already, but I ask every guest, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who's invited? You can invite whoever you want.
Last
living
meal.
Dead, never met them before.
Last meal, they're making it sound really kind of sad. So it's kind of, it makes me think my son, because my son is going to college. So I'm going to, this is the summer from his high school to college. So it's going to be my empty nester syndrome. So maybe that's why I'm thinking about it. It's going to be him, and it's going to be our favorite ramen noodle place that we have eaten every Saturday, if we're in the city, for the last 14 years.
Wow.
It's a ritual. It's a ramen place owned by a Japanese entrepreneur, cooked by Nepalis, which is, by the way, true about most ramen places now. That has been, you can imagine, it's been like with baseball, with soccer. He has played baseball and soccer. And we have, after a game on a Saturday, our thing to do is to eat ramen in this place. And it's a very New York kind of a ritual. An Indian father with a half Indian son in Manhattan, and celebrating our father-son relationship over ramen cooked by Nepali cooks in a Japanese-owned ramenaya. So for me, that's the best place to have the next last meal.
And it's just you two?
Just we two.
That's great. I think that's a great answer.
Thank you.
Krishandu, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've wanted to have you on here for a long time and did not disappoint. And when you're done with your next project, you have to come back.
I would love that. Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me.
And thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week on The Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.